Pull up a chair. I want to take you somewhere. Your GPS has never had to work very hard. The middle of the Pacific Ocean, no islands, no coastline, no lights below you at night, just water in every direction, farther than any airplane of the time had the legs to cross, and a fuel gauge dropping while the sun goes down. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar where we sit around and tell the stories that made this whole flying business what it is. And today we are going to talk about the biggest patch of empty on the whole planet, and the airplane, and the man who refused to believe it couldn't be crossed. His name was Charles Kingsford Smith. The airplane was a three-engine Fokker they called the Southern Cross, and in 1928 they flew her from California to Australia, over the Pacific Ocean in three hops that everybody with any sense said were flat out impossible. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you, the fellas in this story earned about a dozen coins we don't even have names for. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, let me set the scene, the middle 1920s. Back when Avaguez was cheap and airspace was free, and the whole world was busy erasing the blank spots on the map with airplanes. Everybody wanted to be first at something, first across the Atlantic nonstop, that was Alcock and Brown, then Lindbergh solo, first to the poles, first around the world. The oceans were the great dragons left to slay, and the biggest, meanest dragon of them all was the Pacific.
Understand the scale of this thing. The Atlantic, the piece Lindbergh crossed, is a puddle by comparison. The Pacific stretch these men were staring at ran better than 7,000 miles from the California coast to Australia. No airplane on Earth could carry enough gas to do that in one go, so the only way across was to island hop. And the trouble with island hopping the Pacific is that the islands are tiny, they're far apart, and if you miss one, there's no second chance. You don't divert, there's nowhere to divert to. You go in the water and the ocean keeps you. Charles Kingsford Smith, his friends called him Smithy, he was an Australian, a real one, wiry and restless, and he had the flying resume you'd expect from a man who ends up trying something like this. He'd flown in the Great War, been shot up and decorated, lost part of a foot. He came home and did the barnstorming thing, the joyrides, the airmail, scraping money together the way all those early pilots did, one paying passenger at a time. And he got this idea in his head. The Pacific, he was going to be the first to fly it. Now here's where it gets interesting. An idea like that in 1927 is worthless without three things. An airplane that can do it, the money to buy the airplane, and men brave enough or crazy enough to sit in it with you. Smithy spent a couple of years chasing all three, and darn near went broke doing it. Backers pulled out. The Australian government got cold feet. At one point he was washing up in California with almost nothing. The airplane, when he finally got it, was a Fokker, a big high-wing monoplane. The F7 trimotor, three Wright Whirlwind engines. One in the nose, one on each wing. That thick wooden Fokker wing sitting up on top, strong as a barn door. He bought her secondhand, a machine that had been up in the Arctic on an Antarctic expedition ship, and he had her rebuilt and fitted out with extra fuel tanks until she could carry over 1,000 gallons. He named her the Southern Cross, after the constellation that hangs in the southern sky, the one on the Australian flag.
Picture her on the ramp at Oakland, California. Big blue fuselage. Three engines. Registration letters down the side. She is not fast and she is not pretty in the way a racer is pretty. She is a workhorse built to haul fuel across the ocean, and that is exactly what they needed. He had three men with him for the big one. Charles Ulm, another Australian, his partner and co-pilot, the fellow who did a lot of the organizing and money chasing, and two Americans because this was the part the crowds didn't always understand. The flying was only half the job. Harry Lyon was the navigator. James Warner was the radio operator. And on a flight like this, those two men in the back were every bit as important as the two pilots up front, maybe more. Because think about what navigation meant in 1928. There's no GPS, there's no radio beacon out in the middle of the Pacific to home to. Harry Lyon had a compass, a drift indicator, a sextant to shoot the sun and the stars, a watch and a chart. That's it. He is doing dead reckoning and celestial navigation over open water, figuring the wind by looking at the whitecaps, computing where they ought to be, and betting four men's lives that his arithmetic is right. Miss your island by a few degrees over 2,000 miles of ocean, and you fly right on past it into nothing. They left Oakland on the last day of May, 1928. The first hop was California to Hawaii, about 2,400 miles. That one had been done before, so it was the least of their worries,
but 24 hours over water in an open, freezing, deafening cockpit is nobody's idea of easy. And I want you to sit in that airplane with me for a minute, because this is the part the history books skip.
Three Whirlwind engines, no soundproofing to speak of, roaring on either side of your head and right in front of your nose. The noise is a physical thing. It gets into your chest. After a few hours, you can't hear a man shouting 6 inches from your ear, so the crew passed notes back and forth on scraps of paper, pilot to navigator to radio man. The whole flight run on penciled notes, cold air screaming through the cockpit. The smell of gasoline and hot oil and dope off the fabric. Your hands cramping on the controls because there's no autopilot either, boys. Somebody is hand-flying this airplane every single second, hour after hour after hour, holding a heading in the dark while the whole thing pitches in the weather. They made Hawaii, landed, rested, refueled. Then came the leg that scared everybody. Hawaii to Fiji. 3,100 miles. And this was the big one, the longest overwater hop anyone had ever attempted at that point, better than 34 hours in the air with no land under them the entire way, and nowhere to set down if anything went wrong. This was the leg that made the whole flight impossible on paper. This was the Dragon. They launched off a beach in Hawaii heavy with fuel, and pointed her southwest into the Pacific, and that night, they flew into the worst weather of the whole trip. Towering tropical storms, the kind that build up over that warm water into black walls that go higher than any airplane of that era could ever climb over. So they couldn't go over it, they went through it.
Now imagine this. Middle of the night. Middle of the Pacific. Rain, coming through the cockpit like somebody's throwing buckets. Lightning lighting up the inside of the clouds all around you. The airplane bucking and dropping in the turbulence, and Smithy and Ulm up front are hand-flying on instruments that are primitive by anything we'd trust today, a turn indicator and airspeed, an altimeter bouncing around, trying to keep the wings level in the black with nothing to see out the window but rain and their own reflection. In the back, Harry Lyon can't shoot a single star because the sky is gone, so for hours he's navigating blind, pure dead reckoning, guessing the drift, keeping the little pencil line on the chart honest by faith and by feel. And Jim Warner is hunched over his radio set trying to raise anybody, anybody at all, to get a position, tapping out Morse into the storm. They flew through that for hours. Wet, frozen, deafened, exhausted past the point most of us have ever been in our lives. Four men in a wooden wing trim motor in the belly of a Pacific storm at night. And the only way out was forward. And here's the thing that gives me chills every time. When the storm finally let them go and the stars came back out, Harry Lyon shot the sky, worked his numbers, and found out his dead reckoning through all that mess had held. They were right where they were supposed to be. That is not luck. That is a craftsman at the top of his trade doing the hardest job in aviation with a pencil and a sextant and getting it dead right. When getting it wrong meant everybody drowns. They came out of the dark, and there was Fiji, a green speck in a blue ocean exactly where the math said it would be. They'd been in the air the better part of a day and a half.
They rested in Fiji. And then the last hop, Fiji to Brisbane, Australia. Home. About 1,700 miles. And wouldn't you know it, the Pacific saved one more beating for them. They hit another line of vicious storms on the way in, got knocked around all over again. Everybody stretched to the absolute end of what a man can take. But the Southern Cross held together. Those three whirlwinds kept turning. And on the 9th of June 1928, they crossed the Australian coast and put her down in Brisbane. There were something like 25,000 people waiting on the field. Some accounts say more. A whole nation come out to watch four exhausted men climb down out of a blue Fokker that had just done the thing everybody said couldn't be done. First flight across the Pacific from the United States to Australia, better than 7,500 miles of the biggest ocean on Earth, crossed in three hops by an airplane with no radio nav, no autopilot, no de-icing, no pressurization, no nothing but three good engines, a strong wooden wing, and four men who wouldn't quit.
Now I want to tell you what happened to that airplane, because this is a warbird and restoration show at heart, and this part matters. The Southern Cross didn't get scrapped. She didn't rot in a field. Charles Kingsford Smith went on flying her for years. More record runs, the first crossing of the Tasman Sea, a flight clear around the world in stages. And when her flying days were finally done, Australia did the right thing. They kept her. She is still there. That actual airplane, the real Southern Cross, the very Fokker that beat the Pacific in 1928, sits today in a memorial building near the airport in Brisbane. You can walk right up to her, same wing, same fuselage, the genuine article, preserved, not a replica. When I tell you these old birds are worth saving, this is what I mean. A kid in Brisbane can stand under that wing and understand, in a way no book can teach him, exactly how big the ocean is and how much guts it took to cross it.
Smithy himself, sad to say, the sky finally took him. In 1935, he disappeared on a night flight over the sea off Burma, in a different airplane, chasing another record the way he always did. They never found him. The ocean kept him, the way it nearly kept him back in 28, but they named the Sydney airport for him. Kingsford Smith, his name is on it to this day. I got the bones of this story from the historical record kept by the Australian Museums and the Powerhouse Collection that looks after his papers, and from the aviation histories written about the trans-Pacific flights of that era. If it grabbed you the way it grabs me, go read the long version. It's all true, and it's better than any movie. You know, we fly with a Magenta line now that never lets us get lost, and engines so reliable we forget they can quit. That's progress, and I'm glad of it. But every so often it's worth remembering that four men once hand-flew a wooden trimotor through a black Pacific storm on a pencil line and a prayer and made it because they decided the ocean was crossable and then went and proved it. There's more of these tales waiting at radiohanger.com whenever you want them. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the blue side up and give a nod to the Southern Cross next time your autopilot's flying and you've got nothing to do but look out the window at how far we've come. See you next time.